We're back for part two of our interview with Todd Kashtan regarding his book, The Art of Insubordination, and the adage, To Thine Own Self Be True. I hope you enjoyed part one, and if you missed it, be sure to go back and check it out before we get started today.
You know, when I was your age, go ask your mother. I know you don't like it. It builds character. How many times do I have to tell you? I'm not just talking to hear my own voice.
Hello, listener, and welcome to Dadages. I'm your host, Chad Hagel. And if you are looking for some fatherly wisdom for your career, your family, or any other aspect of your life, then you've come to the right place. If you want to learn more about Dadages, find additional content, submit questions, or feedback to me, visit dadages.com. Thanks for being here. And before you listen to our podcast, please listen to your father. That's right, friends and family. We're back today with Dr. Todd Kashtan, professor, author, and as we learned in our last episode, the first twin to appear on Dadages. And we're continuing our discussion where we left off in the last episode. We're getting into a discussion about the structure of his book itself. Get ready to geek out. Picking up on the notion of ideas, and I want to geek out a little bit here on a structural level when it comes to your book, because one of the things I really liked about your book is not just what you say, but how you've structured it for the benefit of the reader. You're really good at taking these concepts, distilling them down, and then presenting them with very clear call-outs. And throughout the book, you call it the big idea that helps people quickly visualize and capture the most important elements out of the text. And then you provide really good exercises and structural ideas and thoughts and work that people can do to specifically focus on some of these topics. So it's like a textbook, it's like a workbook, and then you, at the end, have an index that has all of your terms, and you've put in this great resource for people to dive deeper and read into different topics further beyond what's covered in the book. Does this structure around the book come from your academic background? I get the sense that, like I said, this is a really working text and something that's really usable for the readers and the people that are consuming what you've provided.
Well, thanks for picking up on that framework. I appreciate it greatly. Every book, I try to improve what I do. So this is my third trade book. And for this one, I wanted to be, the original title was The Nonconformist Cookbook. And it was basically like, here are the recipes to actually try to create a more utopian society and try to improve your life to be the most fulfilling possible without stepping on anyone else's toes. And so this is closer to the workshops I lead than the science I conduct, where what do I wish I had as a 21-year-old, overly confident, extremely brash, extremely loud, extroverted New Yorker who's working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And I needed this book to say, you have some decent ideas, but man, you are turning people away with the way that you're actually communicating these ideas. And that's, I thought about, like, let me provide the tools so that anyone who has good ideas can actually frame them in a way that the first goal of a dissenter is simply, do you get an audience that's willing to elaborate on your ideas? Disagree, rejection, or acceptance, they're like, hey, you've got something here, I'll hear you out. So you get a receptive audience. And then only then do you go to the question of, how do I win you over?
Well, and I love that cookbook analogy. I can definitely smell what Todd is cooking. If we talk a little bit further about another element I want to kind of geek out on in the book, I'm always a big fan of well-founded psychological studies. And you picked some very interesting ones to share in the book. And some of them had some very surprising conclusions that were drawn out of the studies. Were there some of these studies that you found in your research that surprised even you, the doctor of dissent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a whole chapter. It's the chapter people either despise or it's the one that they love, which is if you are in the minority, that's not just demographic, numerical power. You're in the minority and then you gain power. You gain allies, you gain traction, and you become the powerhouse, the majority. How do you prevent yourself from being as tyrannical and annoying as the power holders that preceded you? And so I present some really neglected research by some great researchers, which shows that what you find is that invariably, when people switch power positions, they often have non-permeable boundaries where they do not accept the ideas of the now powerless once majority. And you see this almost every election cycle, is that you forget what happened the 4 years or 8 years before, and you don't include them into your cabinet. You don't include them as wise counsel to consider. And it's such a problematic approach to thinking about how do you get leadership succession in an organization, in a team. You know, when you think about, I don't know how many people that are listening watch The Last Dance, the documentary about the Chicago Bulls with, you know, Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, but one of the things that they don't feature is how did Michael Jordan make sure that the Bulls still continue their succession of success in the aftermath of him moving towards retirement? And so as amazing as he was, as amazing as his teammates were on the Chicago Bulls, they really didn't prepare the idea of now that we are the reigning multiple world champions of basketball, what do we do for the next generation to make sure that they can sustain that? And they were a little bit of a tyrannical leadership in terms of, we know the secret sauce, we can keep this going. And the thing is, the DNA of a team or a group changes as soon as the composition brings in new characters. And I think we forget that in the military, General Motors, Apple, Microsoft, you know, or your local PTA meeting.
Yeah, the Bulls certainly didn't thrive in the AM years after Mike. You could see them really recede back to a different level of achievement, and they've never really fully bounced back since then when you look at them across the league. So it's a great example. And, you know, it also plays into what we see in our country right now with the polarization and the sort of windshield wiper vacillating back and forth across the screen of our country as we're switching Republican, Democrat in the leadership of the country. It's tough to shoulder and tough to navigate, for sure.
It's a good metaphor, the windshield wiper, because the best way to think about this is, how would you explain this to a 10-year-old boy or girl? And as soon as you do, they're like, wait, hold on, I don't understand. You're going to have a new leadership and they're going to undo all the laws and improvements in society before, because they want to show that they're smart and they're contributing as well. And as long as you're going, I'm going to undo everything you did, and then I'm going to put it back up when I come back in, you don't think about what's the 20-year plan. You know, and when you have these conversations of, all right, now that you have the proliferation of social media and the decline of community organizations, and there's never been a time in history where there's been lower religiosity and lower spirituality in America ever. So with these historical trends, you can't be thinking about a 4-year plan. You have to think, how do you restructure society so you can have relationships and truly have a village that's interconnected where your needs are met? And so you don't have the health problems and the well-being problems that come from being lonely in a group of people. And that requires people to break out of their political bastions and thinking more broadly of, okay, we have a societal set of issues here.
True, true, very true. I mean, things have become, as I said earlier, so polarized, so reactionary, and they vacillate so much that it's really tough to have any sort of consistency, a consistent narrative, and as you said, a 20-year plan for our country or for any subset of our country. And let's, as I mentioned earlier, let's get into some of the other nuances that you cover in the book that are really directly aligned with some of the things we talk about here on Datages. And I'm going to go actually all the way back to my very first dadage, because in the book, you talk about allies play a critical role in the promotion of unconventional ideas. And that aligns very well with our very first dadage, which was surround yourself with people who are better than you are at what they do best and let them do it. You talk in the book and give some really cool examples of how this isn't just a recipe for success, but in many cases, a recipe for survival for dissenters. And you talked about the example of Charles Darwin, who surrounded himself with supporters and built a movement around his dissenting ideas, whereas others who preceded him actually lost their lives for the sake of their dissension. Can you talk more about how important it is to build groups around dissenting thoughts and what that means?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways to go. Let me discuss some science that's not in the book, almost made it in, which is, imagine that you want to introduce a new approach to whatever organization you're a part of. Maybe you want to have fewer meetings because you realize a lot of these things can be handled by email, which is most of humanity. The way that you want to think about this is, who is going to be your biggest adversary in the group setting when you actually have this conversation. And what we know from the science of persuasion is the best strategy is not to bring up your idea and wait and prepare your answers for the questions you think are going to come from that adversary. Your best approach is to remove the spotlight, hang out with that individual one-on-one, acknowledge that you expect them to be the most challenging and skeptical of your ideas. Mention some of their strengths, some of the things of why you see them as a formidable adversary. They're extremely good at communicating. They're extremely on message. They're a great storyteller. And so you wanted to run by your ideas past them first because you wanted to see, how can I make this better before I bring this in front of the group? In this way, there's a couple things that are happening. You now, when you're in front of the group, can mention, hey, I had this co-creator that was helping me develop these ideas. Mention them. Now they're not the critic in the Q&A. They are now the co-facilitator of bringing these ideas in there. The other part is they now overly identify with the final product because their personal stamp is in there. And so to make this even stronger is to refer to them by name, physically direct your attention towards them, look at them, acknowledge them so that the rest of the room looks at them. And what happens is you bring down their defenses. They're more likely to be curious as opposed to threatened by you. And all of this not only makes you have a stronger relationship, not only makes your ideas more likely to be heard, but it also makes sure is that this room realizes you are not here in a selfish way. You are here for the ideas because look how much you're promoting another person.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine taking it one step further then, if you have the same open mind yourself that you're asking others to have, by engaging with that person with an opposing viewpoint, it may actually reframe or reshape what it is that you want to get across to the rest of the group by taking into account some perspectives that they have that you may not have considered yourself.
Absolutely. So the idea, what we know about dissenter is either your ideas get better, best case scenario, or you realize that your initial ideas are much stronger and can handle a lot more friction than you thought. So you can't lose by facing your adversaries. And yet, so many of us decide that I don't want to run this by someone else because there's so much momentum and we get very attached to energy as opposed to the quality of our ideas and thoughts.
That makes a ton of sense. And it actually speaks to directly to the next topic that I wanted to address, which is actually our most recent Dadage, because we just wrapped up a mini series on diversity, particularly to celebrate Black History Month. But we really focused on a broad definition of diversity, not just the traditional racial, gender, sexuality, all the things that we think about when we think diversity. But we talked about intellectual diversity and diversity of attitudes and perspectives and personalities and how important that is within a group. You said in the book, more frequently than you imagine, diverse perspectives lead in turn to refreshingly counterintuitive ideas and highly workable solutions. The way we put it in our Dadage this last week is diversity in an organization opens many doors, sometimes even ones you didn't know were closed. Can you talk about the importance of diversity and then also why it's so important for those of us who might find ourselves in the majority to still embrace a diversity of perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, this fits with something that we were discussing earlier. And I love your broadened definition of diversity. And I have tried to bring this into the mission statement of universities. It's actually amazing how much friction there is for this idea. I mean, when you think about personality traits just by themselves, they're not evenly distributed for people that are in groups. And so you may have agreeable, kind, compassionate people often get through the door quicker, give or take coding or, you know, police precincts, firefighters, that kind of situation. And you have to ask yourself, what is it going to do to have no quarrelsome, disagreeable people in your group who are highly intelligent and care for the health and longevity of an organization? The reason that you want this wide range of characters is because you want to match whoever ends up being the customer, the client, the piece of person that's going to receive the product that you're creating as a group. And the thing is, it's not going to be a homogenous group of people. So if you have a bunch of optimistic people that are trying to create this really cheery product, well, you have to ask yourself, you need someone to ask the question of, for those people that are in the throes of feeling lost, confused, and unsure about themselves, how are they going to respond to this overly, excessively positive image? And this, what this does is, the benefit is that you have better ideas. The cost is what's called locomotion. The speed to getting things done is reduced. There's an inefficiency in the system by bringing diversity in the system. And I think one of the ways of persuading groups to bring in this wide range of diverse folks is to acknowledge up front there's always a trade-off. Do we care more about the quality of our decisions and the product that we make more than how much we like each other over the course of 1 hour of talking?
Interesting. And you're talking about potential for introducing diverse perspectives and starting to embrace dissent for slowing down organizations, slowing down decision-making, slowing down consensus building. I have to imagine that that may not be the only impact that has a negative implication associated with insubordination and dissent. Can you talk about the parts of introducing even principled insubordination and dissent that may not all be flowers and rainbows, but could have some negative consequences and side effects that you have to watch out for?
Oh, sure. I mean, one of the most stable things that we know is this: to have productive conflict, it needs to be task-focused and not relationship-focused. So one of the mistakes about dissent in an organization is we're going to allow it because we want all voices to be heard, and we care about amplifying those voices that are new or tend to be invisible. Great motivation. Here's the problem. Often what occurs is someone that is atypical in the organization, the first woman to join the board, a newcomer who's only had 1 year of experience. So they haven't been in these conversations to see you're replicating the same problems and discussions over and over again. This is new for them. When they raise these ideas, you think to yourselves, this person doesn't know that much. Maybe they don't belong here. They don't fit in here. That happens here. You move right to relationship conflict and think of, this is someone that is not worthy of being part of our organization. And what you have to clarify up front are the standards and rules of engagement. And one of them is, we're not going to focus on relationships. We're focusing on the tasks and how we make decisions. And we're going to separate that from our relationships. And it has to be reminded over and over again before you have these conversations. One of the things that I often recommend, it's from that checklist manifesto, is having a list of what are the norms that we care about in our conversations. Do we care about harmony or positivity? Or do we care about critical thinking and disagreement? And you want people to say, I am going to commit to disagreeing with the ideas, but not the person. I'm going to commit to assuming positive intent until proven otherwise. I'm going to commit that a person might share their ideas and use the wrong words, but that doesn't mean that they intended harm until proven otherwise. And start with that, where everyone can commit to that over and over again before these meetings, and you're going to get less of that unproductive relationship-based conflict.
Sure. And as a business manager, what about dealing with someone who might be highly productive and valuable to an organization, but seems to just be the perpetual dissenter? How do you rein in those influences to maintain productivity while still embracing the notion of dissent within an organization?
You're hitting such a common occurrence here. So there's two ways I think that you can handle this. One is out of the spotlight, one to two people, preferably two diverse individuals, right? It could be male, female, you name the demographic combo. You're meeting to discuss, how do you think you're coming across? What's going well in terms of these meetings? And what do you think you want to work on? Let them be the person that educates you. First, you're doing a test of self-awareness. If they fail that test of self-awareness, then the question is, do you want to receive some feedback of where there's a little bit of difference in terms of how you're seeing it and how other people are seeing this? And let them know, we are intentionally having this conversation privately, not because we want to be critical, but because you have great ideas. And I think you might not be privy to, there might be a better way for getting those ideas out there. So that you're doing everything possible to reduce the psychological armor that we all wear when we receive critical feedback.
Embrace their ideas in a productive way rather than creating an opportunity for them to grandstand in front of everyone else.
Right. And so you don't want the narcissistic victimhood experience where you attack them in front of the group. They're going to view this as an attack. The other approach, which is, how does the group make rules for communicating? One strategy is that you give people, for example, you know, three conscious, thinking of like Lord of the Flies, where you get to communicate something, but somebody could hand their conch to someone else and say, you know what? I want you to have one more. I like where you're going with this topic.
I yield the floor to the gentleman from Missouri.
Exactly. Right. That happens there. But it's amazing how many, yet you and I are nodding our head. We've both probably read Lord of the Flies. We know this, and yet almost no organization does this. And so we give people whoever can raise their hand the quickest, whoever can be the loudest, whoever has the most tenure seniority. We use these as proxies that you must have the best ideas in the room. And we know this isn't true. And there's no evidence, because often the newcomer who's not inculcated with the dominant, predominant ways of how things are done often asks the very absurd five-year-old question of, why have we been doing it this way? And it's often the best question over a 1.5 hour period.
That's great. Speaking of absurd questions, I want to shift gears now away from a professional environment into a more uncontrolled environment of family life. The way that I know you are an expert on dissent is not your degree. It's not all the books you've written. It's not all the publications or citations. It's the fact that you're a father to three daughters. I know you understand dissent. How do you share the wisdom and knowledge that you have about these subjects without your girls taking all of that wisdom and throwing it right back in your face in the form of complete chaos in the form of, and dissent?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate that because my career allows me to have a lot of time to be there for every sporting event. One of my twin 17-year-olds is my workout partner. And if anyone who's ever had a workout partner knows, is it's kind of like going on a two-week vacation in Cambodia. By the time you're done, you know everything about each other. Let's take my workouts with my 17-year-old daughter, Chloe, as an example. So in this environment, as a dad, obviously I'm very sensitive of, I don't want her to deal with the worst men that I've associated with in the dating world over my lifetime. And so as opposed to lecturing her, there are all these opportunities of exposing, of being exposed to problematic behavior of like, hey, what would you do in the situation right now? So I'll say, hey, did you notice that that guy was checking out over there? Like, I'm curious, if I wasn't here and he approached you, how would you handle that situation being assertive as opposed to passive or aggressive? And we talk about what would be problematic if you were too aggressive. Well, you'll see him here again. Like, it's the gym. There's going to be repeat encounters. Who would you go to if this guy ended up being too in your face, too problematic, too attentive? And then she would point out, this person, that person, that person. Why those people? So we're developing situational awareness. We're developing quick, witty, quippy responses in these kind of situations. And we're also developing a foundation of, you're not, as you mentioned before, you're not alone if a hostile environment occurs. And the question is, how are you going to access your proximal social resources that are right there? What's the way that you're going to do it? Because I'm not always going to be here. And so in some ways, just in this gym environment, I'm training my daughter to travel by herself or with her girlfriends to countries where they might be, you know, very misogynistic in terms of viewing men as superior to women. If you go to Central America or South America, it's tough to be in those countries. And so this gym environment is a safe, low threat place where we get to test out little problems, work with them, deal with all the emotions that arise there. And I'm preparing her so that she can be a good world traveler later.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You're arming her with a skill set that she can implement even when you're not around. And I just wanted to double down on I think the importance of how you're conveying these messages as a father. And it's right up front in the very first page of your book, the dedication. To my three daughters, Raven, Chloe, and Violet, my hope is you are empowered to rebel against every norm, rule, order, and authority figure that warrants insubordination, and you live life on your own terms. One of my life ambitions is to ensure this happens. I think that's just such a fantastic dedication and really shows, like I said, how this book goes beyond just being a working guide for those of us in an academic or professional realm, but really how we can implement these tools as a parent. And I know that you spent the whole last chapter of the book talking about how you can help make children more brave and give them these tools as you were talking about. And I get the sense that that's really, really important to you to be able to pass that to the next generation.
Yeah. And thank you. I mean, I think he was trying to make me cry on camera because I mean, that's it. It hits every time someone mentions.
I have that effect.
That mentions that. I think we're doing a lot of things wrong of how we are helping the next generation. And I think there's good intentions And I think, you know, my friends, John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff in Coddling of the American Mind capture this very well in their book, which is that we are training people to look for things to be offended by. We're training them to be having low agency and assuming things happen to them constantly. And there's nothing for them to actually, for them to respond to beforehand and respond to afterwards. You know, it's just like when you played wiffle ball in the street when you were a kid and you hit it into a tree and you call interference and you get redo. You get to have a mea culpa and say anything the next day to anyone, as opposed to automatically litigating against someone for being, you know, a harmful influence in your world. You get to stand up for yourself, not just in the moment, but three years later, you can approach a mentor at work who you felt like was disrespectful to you and say, I just want you to know, like, your words lingered. And I'm curious if you even thought about that before. And I think giving people agency and empowerment to be active players in their lives is what I'd like to see more in our schools and our workplaces, because we can't assume that every parent has the tools and strategies themselves to pass it on to the next generation.
Amazing. Well, and thank you for helping to give all of us and the Dadages friends and family those tools. So meaningful and so powerful in the way that you've presented it. And as we wrap up today, obviously your books are all available on Amazon for those members of the friends and family who want to check them out. I'd highly encourage it. And if the members of the friends and family don't want their engagement with the Doctor of Dissent to end here, how else can they connect with you? Where can they find you?
I mean, the best place is my website, which is just my name, toddkazhin.com. And I'm in love with writing on Substack because I get to experiment with the next couple books I'm working on now. I love shooting out new science, new ideas, new strategies. And my whole thing is everything gets overly simplified in most self-help books, most Harvard Business Review articles, most LinkedIn posts. And I like the complexity because we are messy, sloppy creatures. And I think I'd like people to think in more complicated ways about just how difficult it is just to approach your neighbor that they're not putting the garbage out or they're leaving the garbage out for too many days. That's a hard interaction because you're going to have repeated encounters with them. And I think we have to honor that it's hard to be human.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the ways that we as human beings can break down those barriers is through humor. And one of the things that we embrace here at Dadages and carry on the legacy is the idea of the bad dad joke. Todd, do you have a really terrible dad joke that you can share with the friends and family?
I mean, there's so many bad ones. As a twin, why did the twins want to move in with each other later in life?
I don't know, Todd, why?
To return to being wombmates.
Wombmates. Oh my. Yeah. But that's doubly bad, Todd.
But it's biologically relevant, so it doesn't have the terror and the awkwardness that most jokes do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's science behind the terrible joke. So yeah, that saves it. Well, Todd, this has been a lot of fun. It's been very informative as well. I'm so glad to have added you to our friends and family. This has been a really enjoyable experience, and I'll look forward to keeping up and seeing what else comes off the presses from you. I can't wait to see what else comes out of the amazing creative process that you've developed for yourself.
No, I appreciate that. And Chad, I view what you do as like the diametrical opposite of intergenerational trauma. Like, I love that you create the universal fatherhood character for those people. Like, there's just a lot of people that just lost the cortical lottery. And it's, you know, and I don't want to give too much blame. I just want to say, I'm glad people like you are stepping in.
Well, thank you so much. Coming from someone that I respect so much, and it's obviously so much background on the topic, and have thought long and hard about these generational issues, that means a lot. And I really appreciate it. And thank you again for being here. And to the rest of the friends and family, I'll remind them, Dad may not always know what he's talking about, but he sure can sound like he does.